Good evening and welcome behind the news for June 7, 2007. This is Doug Hinman. We're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And June 7, that's my half birthday, so I'm just 6 months away from entering the near elderly demographic, something to look forward to. I will be exiting what's called the prime age demographic and entering the near elderly. And I guess that's time for me to get fitted for a cane and some false teeth and start buying Depends by the case. We've got, we've got two segments up for tonight. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Adolf Reed, who is a professor of political scientist at the University, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, and a prolific author and a very great thinker, I think, about politics in the U.S. today. We'll see where that goes. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Anatole Levin, an interview recorded earlier today on the topic of U.S.-Russia relations, what's going on in Russia, what the current tensions between the U.S. and Russia are all about, and the achievements of Vladimir Putin, who is not always a very popular figure outside Russia, although he's an enormously popular figure inside Russia. And before we get to all that, some observations about this and that. I'm writing a little essay for the journal N Plus One on why capitalism needs growth and why, despite all that growth over the decades and centuries, we still have to sacrifice humane pursuits to the gods of GDP expansion. In researching this, I took a look at what has come to be known as the economics of happiness, a small specialty of the dismal science, a field that mostly sees happiness as a simple thing, more money and or more stuff equals more happiness, the end. Well, it's not so simple as the happiness experts could tell you. Research by the British economist Andrew Oswald shows that Americans have become only modestly happier over the last several decades. He finds people moving from a not very happy group to a pretty happy group, with men getting happier and women not getting so much so, but that's about it. And that's come with a doubling of per capita GDP over the last 30 years. But Oswald also reports, based on surveys of a dozen countries, that among the poorest quarter of the population, 19% report being very happy, and 27% not too happy, a spread of 8 points against happiness. Among the richest quarter, 28% report being very happy, and 13% not so happy, a spread of 15 points in happiness's favor. And this is an area where American exceptionalism does not apply. Our rich are also happier than our poor, like the rest of the world. How can these things coexist? How, that is, can rampant and sustained growth not make us collectively much happier over time, while the rich at any given moment are happier than the poor? The main reason is that our sense of how well off we are is highly dependent upon our surroundings. We may feel deprived relative to our rich today, even though people of modest incomes have gadgets like cell phones and iPods that are unimaginable to the rich of 30 years ago. No doubt Marie Antoinette had a few hangovers for which you'd have loved an Alka-Seltzer, but no such thing existed in her day. But that doesn't make our poor rich by the standards of the French 18th century. And our economic system depends upon the creation of dissatisfaction to keep the merry-go-round of consumption spinning. As the great and underappreciated British economist Joan Robinson put it back in the 1970s, the nature of accumulation under private enterprise necessarily generates inequality and is therefore condemned to meeting the trivial wants of a few before the urgent needs of the many. To keep the show going, it is necessary continually to introduce new commodities and create new wants. In a competitive society, a growth of consumption does not guarantee a growth of satisfaction. And the world stock and bond markets have been selling off over the last several days. Today, the stock market was down over 200 points, as measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average, because it's becoming clear that the world's central banks, especially our Federal Reserve, are not going to be cutting interest rates anytime soon. In fact, the European Central Bank raised interest rates the other day. The European Central Bank, or ECB, is a harsh and austere body. Even though the European economies are hardly booming, the ECB is constantly worried about an outbreak of inflation. But what about our Federal Reserve? The U.S. economy turned in the slowest performance in 4 years in the first 3 months of 2007 and is showing signs of only modest revival now. The housing market is weak and likely to get weaker. Despite high oil prices, inflation hasn't taken off, if that is you overlook the price increases in the energy sector itself and in food, where price increases are partly driven by the demand for ethanol and partly by drought. Are we seeing the early economic effects of climate change here? So why is the Fed not cutting interest rates or contemplating it? Why, in fact, is it sending the opposite signal? Because, among other things, at 4.5%, the unemployment rate remains too low for its comfort. When labor markets are tight, wages rise and either put a pinch on profits or push inflation higher or both, and the Fed wants to make sure that neither happens. If, as that awful documentary, The Money Changers, which I denounced last week, were right, and the Fed is a conspiracy by financiers to screw the rest of us, you'd be hearing complaints from industrialists, wouldn't you? You'd think that the sellers of consumer products would like low unemployment rates and rising wages, but they're aware enough of their long-term interests not to complain. They understand that the Federal Reserve is acting as the guardian of the long-term class relations. And on such matters, financiers and industrialists see eye to eye. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Adolf Reed. A bit from Angst in My Pants. I used to suffer from that, but I got cured. That is from the Sparks, or Sparks. I guess there's no definite article on that. Sparks. From an album of theirs in which they covered their own songs called Plagiarism, which came out sometime in the 90s. The original from sometime in the 80s. And we'll be hearing more from Sparks later in the show. And now we're joined on the line by Adolf Reed, a prolific author and professor of political science at Penn. And one of my favorite thinkers in American politics. Welcome to Behind the News, Adolf.
Oh, hi, Doug. And you're one of my favorites. And thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks. okay, so, man, this presidential campaign is giving me a headache. It's, what, 18 months from the election, and we're deep and immersed in this. We're concerned about what's going to happen with the Iowa caucuses already. And we've got debates every other night on the TV, it seems.
Oh, yeah, it's completely insane.
What's going on here?
Well, you know, I mean, the thing that I find most mind-boggling about this is how, on a bass, I mean, this has been happening, of course, increasingly for the last few presidential cycles, but how on a bass the corporate media are now in proclaiming who's a serious candidate and who's not, and, you know, therefore who's worthy of airtime and who isn't, like a year and a half before a vote's cast. Right? Yeah, or
I saw the odious Howard Kurtz from the Washington Post on CNN a couple of weeks ago saying, you know, we should just have a cutoff of like 5% of the polls or something like that. And that even CNN and Fox were being too generous in letting the oddballs on.
That's extraordinary. I mean, they write the polls, right? They conduct the polls, and they handicap the polls pretty much on the basis of who's raised the most money early on. So it's like, you know, I've often said this, it's like running for prince of the fourth grade. Like, if you sell the most candy, you get the nomination, because that's how this thing comes out. But I mean, the idea that they're in a position, right, to pre-screen, as it were, the candidate field, they asserted boldly as a self-evident truth, and I don't hear anybody complaining about it.
Well, how did it work in the old days? I mean, we were often tempted to think that things are worse now than they were in the past, but then it was the party bosses in smoke-filled rooms, wasn't it?
Right. Well, yeah, that's right. But at least what you can say about a process that's brokered by party bosses in smoke-filled rooms is that, I mean, it may sound counterintuitive, you know, considering that there were smoke-filled back rooms, but there was at least some constituent participation and if not oversight, at least some visibility, at least among party activists. Now, you know, I don't think, far be it from me to get nostalgic about the old days, right? The old days weren't the best time in the world for me, certainly. But at least under the old system, at least, on the Democratic side, certainly, but probably on both, it was sort of, you know, the semi-corporatist or quasi-corporatist techniques of, you know, that post-war compact worked to some extent to give some voice to organized interests like labor or the civil rights community, or once you get into the early 70s, you know, the women's movement now. But at this point, I guess this is partly what the triumph of neoliberalism means, that, you know, all those constituent groups are basically cue takers, and their approach to the presidential process, at least on the Democratic side, is to wait and see which candidates the political consultants and the corporate media tell them, and of course, you know, the leading lights of the DNC tell them are the ones who are most electable, and then they just kind of fall in behind them and accept the handicapping. You know, I don't know whether that's, you know, how much it makes sense to say that that's a function of the shift away from smoke-filled rooms to the primary process, and how much it obviously, or rather, how much it's a function of the other political, economic, ideological shifts that have occurred over the last 30 years or so that we all know so well. That is to say, it's not true. You know, I wouldn't want to try to say which way the causal arrow is pointing, and both things have certainly happened. But it's definitely the case that that this process, well, this sucks, I believe would be the best word.
Yes. Well,
you know, my considered judgment as a political scientist.
Yes. I opened this program by quoting Joan Robinson. I'll quote her again. Just all the interesting stuff is assumed away these days.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the pithiest description of our politics that I've heard in a while.
Or as Richard Feinberg, another of my favorite quotes from Clinton's National Security Council, said, democracy only works when there's fundamental agreement on the nature of property.
Yes. Well, that just kind of takes the cover off the whole process, doesn't it?
Yeah, he was talking about Latin America, but I think it applies here, too.
Yep.
Well, what about the shiny and well-spoken Barack Obama, who's the hope of so many? What do you think of
that? Well, you know, Doug, I don't know if you remember this, but one of the things I feel proudest about is that I've actually got a history with Obama that goes back to my opposing him in his first contest for electoral office, which was in my state Senate district in Chicago. It just always struck me as a shiny...
Well, now, the legend is that he had a great semi-radical past as a community organizer and a friend of Palestinians, and he's had to sell out as he's reached national prominence, but there's some defects in his past we don't know about?
Yeah, well, I mean, just that he was always, you know, a smooth foundation confection, right? And that's always where his base was. You know, the community organizing stuff was, you know, it was just that kind of each one teach one, you know, foundation-funded activities that was always, you know, that was always much more appealing to that strain of upper-status liberals than it was effective at trying to challenge anything. Or
let's mull over that point for a second, because a lot of people put a lot of stock in community organizing and such. I've always been distrustful of a lot of it for precisely the reason you bring up, that a lot of it's more responsive to program officers at big foundations as their constituency rather than the communities for which they purport to speak. Is that your experience in Chicago?
That's my experience. That's my experience going back to being an organizer in the war on poverty. I mean, that's and when we think about it, I mean, that's, well, it's also, you know, my experience from watching those, you know, those things in Chicago. And when you think about it, you know, what we call community-based organizations in the U.S. are, you know, are are the same as and function the same as what are called non-governmental organizations outside the U.S. And the big foundations have been pushing. Ford started doing this in the late 70s and the early 80s, pushing these small community-based organizations as more authentic alternatives to more formalistic, abstract, state-based structures, as being better able to get things done, as being more in tune with the needs of local communities, both
and
here and
civil
abroad.
Civil society, their magic word.
Yes, right, exactly. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, when you look at the vector of accountability, right, it goes to the program officer, much more than it goes toward the warrants of the population who are supposedly served. And I think a crucial distinction, too, that very often gets overlooked in the pageantry of local mobilization is that what those community-based organizations mobilize to do is provide services, not to not to funnel political will and political action. So it's a notion of activism that's a little more like running around in circles, trying to fill some of the gaps in service provision that should be provided by a strong that really can only best be provided by a strong central authority, with the only real kind of democratic accountability that there is, which is accountability that runs through public institutions, with this facade, it's easy to beat up on neoliberalism today, at least on your program, where the rest of the day it beats up on us. But I mean, this is one of the, one domain of the quintessence of the neoliberal victory, right? That we've come to mistake that kind of stuff for what used to be called in other contexts activism.
Yeah, I'm turning into a quote machine today, but another one from old Karl Marx, who said that the better a ruling class is able to absorb the natural leaders of the oppressed classes, the more solid and dangerous its rule. And that seems to be
absolutely
what that community organization bit is all about.
Well, and look, you know what? Like, if we go back as far as the 60s, the Ford Foundation. I was stunned, actually, to learn that a colleague of mine who was a graduate student at Yale when I was on the faculty there wrote his dissertation on peasant politics and land reform in what was first Rhodesia and then Zimbabwe. And when I was reading his dissertation, I was startled to find that Ford was running the same kind of development programs with the same kind of rhetoric in Rhodesia pre and post the UDI that they were running in black and Latino communities in the U.S. at the same time. And a big focus of their work was on leadership development. Well, it sounds nice, but what does it mean? And it means precisely that. It means providing a discourse frame and a system of rationality for active grassroots types. Here and elsewhere, and frankly, I mean, that connects with what happened to black urban politics and Latino urban politics, even now that we're living through this moment of what a friend of mine in LA calls Chicano triumphalism around the Villaraigosa administration, just as it had in Latin America and in the 80s when the Stanford and MIT trained economists started popping up as foreign ministers, or rather as economics ministers, all over Africa and Latin America. I mean, it's precisely as you and a smart old man observed.
Well, we've taken a little detour away from Barack Obama, but this is the world he emerges from, and now he's on the big stage.
Yeah, that's right. And it's funny, there too. I mean, it's there's a merry-go-round, with a guy like him. I mean, he's, because the story is, I have a very good friend who I won't name, but we've been, he's a longtime leftist and was my doctor in Chicago. And we had a good-natured disagreement about Barack from his very first campaign. And I've called him for another reason, actually, after Barack won the U.S. Senate seat out there. And I asked him how he was feeling, and my friend said, I'm not feeling so great. I think your boy's going to break my heart. And I said, so what, has he sold you out already? And he said, no, he hasn't sold out yet, but I wouldn't say that, but he's definitely put the for sale sign in the front lawn. And he's rolled on his support for health care legislation, first in the state of Illinois, then, you know, then in the U.S. Senate. He's backed up on the war. I understand now that his claim is that, you know, we need to have 100,000 more troops in a standing army so that we'll be able to intervene any place we need to. But the logic gets to be that, well, for me to be able to get elected as a liberal, especially as a black liberal, I've got to find a way to palliate the concerns that other people, some unnamed others, might have that I'm too liberal, so I can't really stand for anything. But it's important for me to, you know, for you to support me because it's important for me to win, you know, even though I'm not standing for anything and I won't do anything. One of my frustrations about the presidential politics this year on the Democratic side is that Hillary and Barack, you know, stand to turn this whole thing into an Oprah-worthy identity fest, right? So that we'll get to celebrate the diversity while both of them are just corporate pimps, and nobody will ever talk about that. So, you know, I mean, so there, you know, there we have it. I mean, even a guy like Edwards, who is not the greatest thing in the world, but certainly was the one of the big three, you know, supposedly, who is trying to, however tepidly or ineffectually, trying at least to push some questions about inequality out there, at least to use the words, can't get any pub because he's a boring white guy, and you don't have the happy face, story of the diversity, you know, with the, you know, HRC and Barack.
Well, he's a millionaire trial lawyer with expensive haircuts. So,
right, exactly.
That's his identity category.
Right, yep.
We're speaking with Adolf Reed, professor of political science at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I'm often tempted just to give up on the whole presidential thing. As the unreconstructed Trotskyists at Workers' Vanguard say, the president is the chief executive of the world bourgeoisie, and you're not going to get anything good coming out of a candidate for that office. So let's look at a more hopeful layer or level of politics, rather. You've been deeply involved in organizing the Labor Party for many years now. What's the state of play there?
Well, the main thing on our plate now is, I think you know, we spent most of last year working to get a ballot line in South Carolina, and we succeeded. And we founded the South Carolina Labor Party in September of 06. And since that time, we've been organizing around the state. We've right now got serious organizing activity going on, like in the Charleston area and up around Florence, and in the some going around Anderson and a couple of other parts of the state. And the idea is that we're trying to build a base for engaging in state and municipal level and county level elections in South Carolina, ideally within the next year or so, to test the proposition that which had a lot to do with our decision to do it in South Carolina. I mean, there are other reasons as well we could talk about, but the test of proposition that if working people of all sorts are given a political program and confronted with a political force that is purely committed to defining and addressing a politics that's built around concern with the practical issues that working people of all sorts in this country fret about most of the day, from the time they get up in the morning till the stuff that keeps them awake at night, that they will respond to it, that all the talk coming from Democrats and other liberals about how you can't really press against or push a progressive social or political and economic program in a context where so much of the rank and file electorate is riven by racial and ethnic divisions or moved more by moral and religious issues than they are by economic issues is just wrong. And we figured, you know, we thought that South Carolina, well, there couldn't be a better place.
Yeah, I was going to say South Carolina. My first reaction in hearing South Carolina is racially deeply divided, white population, extremely conservative, hopeless territory.
Right.
So,
which is
how have you found it? Is it as hopeless as it seems to a superficial Yankee like myself?
Well, on a superficial level, I think you're absolutely right with that diagnosis. But you know, we've had pretty good success down there organizing for several years, at least 6 or 7 years. And before our decision to go down there, the South Carolina State AFL-CIO is a Labor Party affiliate.
There are actual unions in South Carolina.
Not that many. You know, South Carolina and North Carolina keep passing back and forth almost on a weekly basis the title of having the lowest union density, as the buzz phrase calls it now, in the country. So the labor movement there is strong, or rather small and is weak, but it's also well organized and frustrated with the options that exist. I mean, the two biggest central labor councils affiliated with the Labor Party and the state AFL-CIO is affiliated with the Labor Party. We work very closely with the Charleston Longshoremen. After a year or so of talking about it, we decided that we had enough of a base of support to take this idea out and to see how workers in South Carolina responded to it. And the first hurdle was we had to collect 10,000 valid signatures of registered voters in the state and present those to the State Election Commission. And we did. I mean, we went out, you know, we organized a campaign that was centered on working flea markets, which are the working class shopping malls in much of South Carolina, in different sections of the state, and doing some door-to-door stuff and working festivals and that kind of thing. And last July, we submitted more than 16,500 signatures to the State Election Commission of registered voters in South Carolina of all sorts, saying that they thought that the state should recognize a Labor Party, you know, which you wouldn't think would happen all that easily in South Carolina. But the responses that we got were pretty much that people, you know, a lot of people said it's about time that somebody in South Carolina, you know, that some political party in South Carolina really promised to speak on behalf of the kinds of issues that people are actually concerned about. And now this is in a state where, as you know, the last big political controversy was about flying a Confederate flag over the state house, and the Republicans had put an initiative on the state ballot that would write the existing statutory prohibition on gay marriage into the state constitution. It was, you know, the only purpose that it served was to further polarize the electorate. And what we found striking was that hardly anybody ever asked us about those issues.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but what are you going to do with this ballot line? Are you going to run any candidates anytime soon?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're we've got an organizing plan, that we're working on over the summer, and by the early fall, we're going to make a decision about whether and where to field candidacies in 08. And I should say, if anybody's interested and would like to contribute to it, because we've also got fundraising going on across the country, to support this. Check the Labor Party website at www.thelaborparty.org and send checks to the Labor Party at 5317, Post Office Box 53177, Washington, D.C., 20009.
TheLaborParty.org, right?
Yep.
Okay, thanks for joining us, Adolf Reed. We're out of time.
My pleasure as always, Doug.
I'll be speaking with Adolf Reed, professor of political science at Penn, and let's take a break for Station ID, and we'll be back to hear from Anatole Levin. Well, that's a pretty good station ID, I got to say. This is WBAI 99.5 in your FM dial on the web at WBAI.org. And let's take a musical break, and I'll be back to introduce Anatole Levin. No heavy message, baby, just a perfect blend of sex and noise. And that's what we aspire to sometimes, but surrounded by heavy messages. Now, speaking of a gloomy business, U.S.-Russia relations, which have been getting nastier and nastier, tenser and tenser. And the most recent point of conflict is the U.S. plan to base anti-missile systems in Poland and the Czech Republic. Washington says these are aimed at terrorists, but the location rightly excites Russian suspicions that they're aimed, if they ever work, of course, at neutralizing Russia's nuclear missile capacities and maximizing the U.S.'s freedom of maneuver, which is always what the U.S. Foreign policy seems to be about. So, in the light of this, I thought I'd give Anatole Levin a call. Anatole Levin is a fellow at the New America Foundation based in Washington, D.C., and all-around expert on that part of the world, and also U.S. foreign policy. In this interview, he refers to the murder last October of the journalist Anna Politkovskaya, which was widely viewed in the U.S. and elsewhere as a sign of growing repression under Putin, but which, in fact, was probably nothing of the sort. Anatole Levin. Welcome, Anatole Levin. Sometimes it feels like a new Cold War all over again. We've got the U.S. and Russia exchanging barbs now over U.S. Anti-missile defenses in Eastern Europe. Is it as dire as it looks?
I don't think it's as dire as the Cold War analogy would suggest. After all, you don't have hundreds of thousands of Russian and American troops facing each other in the heart of Central Europe. You don't have Soviet communism as a global alternative, at least, you know, in the eyes of many people around the world, to Western democratic capitalism and so forth. This is more a set of local problems. Problems which, by the way, I would say are not necessarily even very significant often when compared to the issues between the US and China, for example. And yet somehow those issues are generally regarded, not just in America but in Europe as well, with far less heat and anxiety than our difficulties with Russia.
Well, it seems to me that the U.S. liked it very much in the 90s when Russia was flat on its back. Yeltsin was taking dictation from the IMF and the Harvard Economics Department, and there was not really much of a challenge to the United States coming out of Moscow. Now Putin is acting quite assertive. Russia can't be pushed around anymore. Its economy seems to be booming. And is it just that the United States can't adjust to the renaissance in Russia over the last 5 or 7 years?
Yes, I think that is very largely it. And not just the West, the U.S., but to a great extent Western Europe as well. I mean, many of us did warn Western officials again and again in the 1990s that it was a very bad idea to force agreements on Russia, which most Russians even then regarded as flatly contrary to Russian national interests. Because if Russia ever really did recover, it would not only seek to reverse some of those decisions, but it would do so in a spirit of tremendous resentment and bitterness, which you also see among Russian officials. You know, they're not just playing a realist game; they are also very angry often, which, you know, doesn't help matters.
How much is the Russian revival dependent upon oil prices, or is there more to the economy than just exporting oil?
It's largely dependent on oil and, of course, gas prices, and to a lesser extent, other commodity prices and raw materials prices, all of which have been driven up by the increasing demand from China. That's why, even if the economy is largely dependent on this, it's a factor which is unlikely to go away for a considerable time. So, you know, no serious analyst that I've seen thinks that in the next few years, at least, there's going to be a serious drop in the oil price. But it isn't only that. International investment in Russia, in the economy as a whole, has been growing very steeply in recent years. There's a big expansion in parts of the manufacturing sector. And all this, in turn, has been related to the restoration of, you know, a certain level of central state power and of legality in the economic sphere. Now, of course, it's also been associated with, you know, a considerable drop in democracy and media freedom. But as far as the conditions for raising revenue, for spending revenue in ways that are beneficial for the economy, building up massive reserves for the sake of macroeconomic stability, the Putin administration has actually had a very good record. It's been doing, in general, many of the things that we told the Yeltsin administration again and again to do, and it either couldn't or wouldn't do.
What about how much of this is his own personal cunning and strength and popularity, and how much of it is a transformation in the larger Russian political economy? And what is the root of his power? What is his social base?
I think that Putin has created a system which will outlive him. It won't, I mean, it'll outlive his presidency. It won't last forever, but I think it most probably will remain stable for a considerable time to come, because it rests on two things. One is a very tight oligarchy made up of chiefly security officials or former security officials who don't just control the security apparatus and the political apparatus and much of the media, but of course, most importantly, they've also been given control of the most profitable sections of the economy, oil, gas, and to a lesser extent, minerals. But secondly, and this cannot be ignored either, the strength of this system rests on the fact that most of Putin's policies, not all, and these are policies which will be continued by his successors, do enjoy very great popularity in Russia. Every opinion poll, including independent opinion polls, suggests this. And that's not just because of manipulation by Putin. It's also because, especially after the experiences of the 1990s, most Russians actually like what he's doing. Well, as long as he and his successors can continue to do that, in part on the basis, once again, of high oil and gas prices, you're not going to see, I think, you know, any major popular upsurge against them. I do think that will come. I don't think that, you know, this is a system that will last forever. But I think it could easily last, shall we say, a decade or two.
If we go back to the late Yeltsin years, it looked like this was a country that was about to fall completely apart, and now it looks anything but that. How did Putin manage to gain control over what looked like a very powerful, corrupt oligarchs and a social system that just seemed to be flying out of control? What was the source of this adhesive that he managed to apply?
The most important factor has been the security forces, I mean, notably the former KGB. It turned out that they were more cohesive and potentially much more powerful than we realized, possibly than they themselves realized, and they are the core of Putin's institutional strength. Beyond that, I think he acted in a rather subtle and intelligent way to target and destroy or exile some of the oligarchs, the so-called oligarchs, I prefer to call them business magnates, you know, who had really challenged state power in the 1990s. But he didn't go after the class in general. Most of the former oligarchs have been co-opted into the system. So he didn't launch the kind of full-scale assault on big business, which would have, I think, destroyed what was left of the economy and, well, ruined the whole system. Secondly, I don't see Putin within the Russian oligarchy as an autocrat. Actually, in many ways, he's behaved more like a kind of chairman of the board or first among equals. And People who, you know, have opposed him to a limited degree or not done what he wanted have not actually been destroyed or exiled or murdered. They've been shifted out of one position to a different position, less powerful, though possibly just as profitable. Now, there are good and bad sides to this. The good side is that, you know, I mean, given Russia's dreadful history, the last thing you really want is a ruthless autocrat. The bad side is, of course, that it's meant, amongst other things, that he has been pretty tolerant of corruption in the top levels of the system. Indeed, you could say that his whole system depends on corruption, or perhaps patronage would be a politer way of saying that. And shuffling patronage around the leading supporters of his regime so that nobody is so discontented that they actually want to leave the system and attack it from outside.
From the far left to the far right, along the Western political spectrum, there's almost universal condemnation of Putin as an autocrat, as a reincarnation of Stalin almost. It seems to me that his achievements are quite remarkable. He's certainly no angel, but stabilizing Russia and turning around its economy seem like remarkable achievements. Why can't he find a friend in the West?
Yes, I've often wondered that myself, particularly, you know, as I often say, when we contrast it with the far more positive views of the Chinese leadership, who are, of course, still communist and at least formally totalitarian rulers of their country, and certainly have carried out, you know, human rights abuses on a far larger scale than in Russia, at least if you leave the Chechen war aside. I think it's partly that, you know, we had these messianic hopes for Russia in the 1990s, and Russia, in a sense, has betrayed the magic. It's been the biggest example of the fact that our mixture of democracy, Western interests, and free market capitalism do not necessarily work. So I think that's part of it. I think that there are also particular prejudices against Russia in general, not just because of the Cold War, but because of older histories involving Poland and so forth, which don't apply to China. And I think you have lots of structures in the West, which, you know, grew up during the Cold War, which never could tell the difference between the Soviet Union and Russia, and have simply continued the Cold War. But finally, I think that Putin's personality has something to do with it. If, for example, General Alexander Lebed had become president of Russia in the mid-1990s, you would have seen, I think, many of the same policies pursued that Putin has pursued. But possibly, as, you know, a general with a kind of warmer Russian personality, he might have gained more personal sympathy in the West than this extremely cold-blooded but highly efficient former, well, spy.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin, who is a fellow at the New America Foundation.
So listen to some of the press. You think that Russia is once again a police state. It's like a return of KGB shutting down the press and arresting dissidents. Just how bad are the state of civil liberties in Russia now?
It's a mixed picture. I mean, I would compare it to some extent to somewhere like Turkey over most of the past 50 years. I mean, Turkey actually went through periods which were much more authoritarian and ruthless than Russia. But for most, until quite recently, and even to a degree today, Turkey has been a managed democracy in which the military, the security forces, have placed pretty strict limits, both on what elected governments can do, but also on what the media can say. But they are specific limits in particular areas. They're not universal. When I was last in Moscow, I talked to a senior Russian journalist working for state television about what he and his colleagues were allowed to say and what they were not allowed to say. And he said, we're actually allowed to discuss almost everything. We can condemn government policy on most issues, you know, very harshly indeed. There are three areas where we're limited. Not absolutely, but limited. The first is personal criticism of Putin. In other words, you can say that a particular government policy is idiotic. You'd be unwise to say that the president is an idiot for adopting it. Secondly, Chechnya. You can condemn, you can even condemn pretty severely Russian abuses in Chechnya. What you mustn't do is what Politkovskaya did, which is basically come out on the Chechen side and express sympathy for Chechen independence. And thirdly, he said, you can criticize corruption as much as you like, and you can criticize corruption, named corruption, at the junior and even middle-ranking levels as much as you like. What you mustn't do, if you value your job and possibly even your life, is actually accuse very senior people, including Putin, by name of specific acts of corruption. So, you know, but he said beyond that, I mean, and those are pretty important restrictions, be it said. He said beyond that, you could, even on the state media, you can be very critical. And, of course, the print media remains generally very free. People in the newspapers are amazingly critical, even of Putin himself. Of course, as is often pointed out, most people get their news from television, not from the print media. As far as really severe repression is concerned, Politkovskaya, well, we don't know who killed her. The most plausible thing would seem to be Russia's Chechen allies, but it could have been the former KGB. One does have to point out that that was very, very much the exception. You get these figures of large numbers of Russian journalists having been killed. What is not usually mentioned is the fact that they were not killed by the state. It's the pattern of the Philippines or Mexico, whereby it's not the government ordering the death of these people. It's the fact that they have offended in some way some local bigwig who then has them killed by the mafia. So, you know, there is a measure of genuine repression, but it doesn't begin to compare, once again, with the level in China, for example.
What do you make of Washington's policy of towards Russia? Do they understand what's going on? What are they trying to accomplish? Is there division within the administration?
Well, the divisions within the administration seem to have receded somewhat, unfortunately. As to what they're trying to accomplish, I think what they're trying to accomplish is something which is completely irrational, which is to push back Russia on every single possible front simultaneously, including ones where it should be quite obvious by now, like NATO membership for Ukraine, that it's simply not going to happen because most Ukrainians don't want it, and the Ukrainian political system is too deeply divided on this and other subjects. But it doesn't seem to be possible for, not just, I have to say, the Bush administration, but for the Democrats either, at least potentially if they ever come to power, to prioritize, to say, for example, to themselves and then to the Russians, look, what really, really matters to us is the Iranian nuclear program. Help us on that. Really help us on that. You know, back severe sanctions if the Iranians don't comply. And, you know, we will stop pushing you on lesser issues, Georgia getting back Abkhazia and South Ossetia, or, you know, further NATO enlargement, or, well, these absurd missile defenses in Eastern Europe. The Russians have said again and again in private that they are willing to do practical deals of that kind. The Russians are nothing if not realist in their attitude to foreign policy. The problem is that for a mixture of anti-Russian feeling, political divisions within the United States, the power of certain lobbies, the power of ideology, it just doesn't seem to be possible for the U.S. establishment, or, well, the European establishment either, for a rather different set of reasons, to actually formulate clear priorities in that way. And so, of course, if the Russians feel themselves pushed, you know, on every single point, well, naturally they push back. I mean, just as the U.S. would if it felt pushed, you know, by another country. That doesn't mean that they're incapable of compromise. I mean, Putin, I have to say, to my astonishment, has just come up with what could be a good compromise regarding an anti-missile system, for example.
Citing the missiles in Azerbaijan?
Yes. Yes, which, I mean, one has to recognize would be a tremendous concession, you know, from the Russian point of view, so much so that I would almost suspect it's an attempt to lead the United States into a trap, because, you know, the U.S. then becomes utterly committed to an authoritarian and potentially ramshackle regime in Azerbaijan and could be severely embarrassed as a result. Also, of course, it would really infuriate the Iranians and maybe make any settlement to that issue out of the question. So I would treat Putin's offer with considerable wariness. On the other hand, I mean, on the face of it, as I say, it is a major Russian concession aimed at a reasonable-looking compromise.
From the sound of it, it's as if the Bush administration has learned almost nothing from its experience in Iraq, that the unilateralism has produced nothing but disaster, yet they keep pushing hard against Russia. Are the lunatics really still in charge of the asylum?
Well, I wouldn't describe Condoleezza Rice as a lunatic. The problem is that, you know, she's not a strong Secretary of State. She has never been prepared really to go out on a limb to stop a policy that she is supposed, you know, in private to regard as foolish. She's also lost one of her principal allies, Tom Graham of the NSC, when it comes to a rational policy towards Russia. But for all the domestic reasons that I mentioned, you know, to draw up a new policy towards Russia would demand considerable political courage, not just from the Bush administration, but from the Democrats as well. And very few people seem to be prepared to do that or to show that. I think part of the problem as well is that when it comes to taking a hard line against Russia, the administration can appear to be not unilateral, but multilateral, because there is a lot of anti-Russian feeling in Europe, particularly, of course, among the East Europeans and the Balts. But also, even those countries or those leaderships which are worried about American policy are very unlikely to come out and denounce it publicly or openly. And so you have a situation in which we'll take this missile screen business. There's a lot of unhappiness, in the general publics in Europe, including even Central Europe. But the European governments, unlike over Iraq, say, or over global warming, have not been prepared to come out and actually denounce, and oppose U.S. plans. And this, of course, is a tremendous problem from the Russian point of view, and it's one reason why, you do have these extremely unfortunate threats now directed, not just against the U.S., but against Europe as well, because the Russians are fed up with seeing a situation in which, again and again, as with, for example, America's pulling out of the ABM treaty 4 years ago, they're told in private by the Europeans that, of course, they deplore what America is doing. But when push comes to shove, the Europeans, will not back Russia in public. And so the Russians have more or less given up on the Europeans as a serious international force in many ways, except, of course, when it comes to trade, economics, and energy.
All right. Thanks, Anatole.
A melancholy pleasure, if I may say.
Okay.
And that was Anatole Levin, a fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, who covered the former USSR, Central Europe, Afghanistan, and Pakistan for the Financial Times and the Times of London. He's the author of several books, including America Right or Wrong, A Historical Anatomy of American Nationalism, and he's been a frequent guest here on Behind the News. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I'll be back next week. Let's go out with this, also from Sparks, a song that got cut short last week, La Dolce Vita. Till next week, bye. Give me a light.